Listen very carefully to what this man says. Dr. Bernard Heisch is extremely credentialed. He's an astrophysicist. He's written over 130 scientific publications, served as scientific editor of the Astrophysical Journal, I guess it is a journey, for 10 years, was principal investigator on several NASA research projects. Professional positions included scientist at Lockheed Martin Solar and Astrophysics Lab and deputy director of the Center for Extreme Ultraviolet Astrophysics at the University of California, Berkeley. Now, from a person of this magnitude, would you expect to be hearing what you're hearing tonight? I think not. Doctor, you've obviously considered reincarnation. So would you imagine or guess, Doctor, that reincarnation is an endless process that, or at least as we humans can consider endless, or is there a sort of a gentle karmic learning process that results in something other than yet another and another and another birth? Is there a graduation?
I think there is. I think the ancient view was that time was a cyclic thing, and therefore there was the belief that if you do come back again, you have to somehow live a life that will get you out of this, that will get you out of this treadmill of reincarnation. And I think the view we have now, certainly one consistent with what modern science is telling us, is that things evolve, physical life forms evolve. And so I think that just as physical life forms evolve, probably our spiritual nature evolves. And so the education, the experience, the good and the bad that we take with us from any given life hopefully takes us on an upward path so that somehow whatever that consciousness of ours is evolves in a way that's kind of parallel to the evolution of life in a physical form on planet Earth. So I do think that it's an upward journey. I think ultimately it probably does lead to reunification with the ultimate intelligence, because I think that's what we are. It's sort of like a giant bonfire out there that is that intelligence behind the universe, and we're little sparks, little flames of that bonfire. But ultimately we return to the ultimate bonfire that's there.
All right, what about the old question of, well, if reincarnation is in fact the way it happens, how do you account for the increasing number of consciousnesses present on Earth?
Well,
radically increasing.
Whether there's a fixed supply or not, I wouldn't know that. So, you know, you can always have more consciousness arising if the intelligence behind the universe is an infinite consciousness, which I suspect it is. So I don't think I don't think there's any shortage, actually.
Okay. All right. Let's try this then. If reincarnation is sort of a progressive thing, then one would imagine that you'd be able to see the social evidence here on Earth of that progression. And maybe I'm just too much of a pessimist to be able to see it.
Well, it is kind of worrisome, isn't it, that we're still quarreling with each other after all these centuries. But I do think
that
some of the laws that we've adopted, for example, the emphasis these days on human rights, you know, that was not part of human civilization anywhere on the planet in the past, in the not that distant past. The rights of women, the increasing equality of the sexes in the Western civilizations anyway. I think there is evidence that we are moving upward, but unfortunately it's a very zigzag kind of upward trajectory.
But you think if you were to look at the totality of what we can actually document of human history, that you can show that progress sufficiently so you could say, well, yes.
Well, I guess it kind of looks that way to me, but I guess I'm putting some slightly rose-colored glasses on because I prefer to think that's the case, and that we can evolve, we can become better human and spiritual beings as we learn from the experience of life.
What is the zero-point field in physics?
Well, now you've gotten into an area that could take a long time to discuss, and this gets us. I'll have to put on my best Carl Sagan here, because now we're talking about hardcore science.
Okay.
It's the energy that remains when all other energies are moved from a system. It's a quantum law. For example, we know zero-point energy is a reality because liquid helium, when you try to freeze it, take it down to a temperature near absolute zero, just refuses stubbornly to freeze unless you put it under pressure. because zero-point energy keeps the jiggling motions from being entirely stopped. So we know that we have to deal with the phenomenon of zero-point energy, and the question is, where does it come from? It comes from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, a basic law of quantum mechanics that says you can't ever take the last bit of energy away from anything. And so if we apply that law to light, a radiation field, we find that there is a certain amount of energy that you simply can't take away, and that I call it sort of a quantum light, a virtual form of quantum light underlies the universe. And that's zero-point energy. And the question is, to what extent is that energy real or virtual? And that's still a very controversial topic, because the work that I've done over the last decade or so, which was funded by Lockheed Martin and by NASA, suggests that there may be some fundamental physics that can be traced back to the zero-point field that has to do with the nature of matter and mass. It has to do with basically the stability of matter, the ability of it to resist the acceleration and thereby make possible a stable, solid world for evolution to take place on. So I would say, if you look up zero-point energy or zero-point field on the web, beware of what you find, because most of what you find there will be kind of a catch-all form of nonsense that has very little to do with the reality of the zero-point field and zero-point energy as studied in physics.
And there are those who point to the zero-point field and equate it with God, yes?
There are, and that's a very superficial comparison, because the zero-point field is defined very precisely in physics. It has to do with quantum radiation. Very precise, very limited definition. Now, might there be something deeper to it than that? I admit I do speculate on a deeper connection in my book, especially the one having to do with the work that we did over the last 10 or 12 years, suggesting that maybe the inertia of matter could be traced back to the zero-point field. That sort of metaphorically implies, well, there's an underlying form of quantum light that makes the world solid and stable. Gee, that begins to sound kind of esoteric. That begins to sound like it may be a physics perspective on something that the religious traditions have alluded to. And it's that kind of connection that I speculate about in the book, but I wouldn't want to take it any deeper than that, because it is purely speculation.
You apparently feel that physics in the modern world is facing some kind of crisis today. Is that correct?
Well, it is, in fact. Now, I'm looking at this from a slightly a neighborly perspective, not a direct one, because I'm not a physicist. I'm an astrophysicist, an astronomer, either one. And they're very similar, but they're not the same. They're different communities, different journals, different meetings. But the problem with physics today is that so much of physics has gotten tied up with string theory. There are literally thousands of physicists working on string theory and publishing thousands, if not tens of thousands of papers a year on string theory. And the problem is that string theory has absolutely no experimental verification, not even any suggested test that could demonstrate whether it's right or wrong.
Well, now, wait a minute. There is what's going on at CERN, and they have hopes.
Hopes. They have hopes of detecting. Yeah. That's yeah. Right. They have hopes of detecting, say, the Higgs boson. That's not string theory. The detection of strings is utterly beyond anything we could even imagine now, because the size scales of strings are maybe 20 orders of magnitude. I'm using scientific terminology, I'm sorry. But many orders of magnitude smaller than anything we could possibly detect in any collider that could be built on the planet. There's beginning to be some dissension from string theory. There have been a couple of books that have come out in the last year, one by Peter White. He's a mathematician, I believe, at Columbia University. He wrote a book called Not Even Wrong about string theory. And then the physicist Lee Smolin, a very respected theoretical physicist, has just written a book, and it's called The Trouble with Physics. He talks about the fact that string theory has this magic hold on the communal mentality of physics, and that it's really achieved nothing provable in 20 years of research. So I think there is a problem with physics today, and I think there's a new impetus that is necessary. I'm not quite sure from which direction that will come. I kind of hope it might come from the direction of some of the relationships we think we've found between the quantum vacuum and the mass. But there is kind of a bottleneck that's happened in physics over the last few years.
Is there, therefore, a problem with the multiverse theory?
Well, the multiverse theory is, of course, the alternative theory to the one that I'm proposing that addresses why is our universe special. You know, I alluded to the fact that there are maybe half a dozen properties of our universe that really seem to be just right, for planets to arise around stars and have conditions that are conducive to life. And in fact, we could talk about those at any length that you want. So those properties of the universe have to be explained somehow. You can't get away from them. They're pretty much accepted and undisputed that the universe is kind of uniquely tuned toward life. So to explain that away, which is what most scientists would prefer to do, implies that you have to have lots and lots of other universes that are different than ours, so that ours becomes not really special, just this is the one we're in because we couldn't exist in any of the other hypothetical ones. And my suggestion is that, well, maybe it's not a bunch of other universes. Maybe it's that there is an intelligence behind this universe. So that's the situation on the multiverse. You need to have that if you want to have an explanation for our special universe without resorting to some kind of intelligence behind it.
Gee, Doctor, you put yourself in a unique position. You're going to have everybody angry at you.
Well, I hope I have people curious about what I say, because I would like
to oh, of course. It's fascinating, and I'm with you. I'm just saying that the scientific community is probably going to be banging on your head, and the religious community is probably going to be trying to sock you in the stomach.
Well, that's quite possible, and I would suggest that both sides go to my website, thegodtheory.com, and see some of my questions and answers and some of my perspective on why I've written this book, because I wrote it because I think that ideas like this could put the planet in on a better trajectory. If we could put behind us some of the outdated ideas of religion, some of the aspects of religion that are causing more problems than they're benefiting mankind, we would be in much better shape. And on the other hand, I don't think that a kind of materialistic philosophy that says, look, there is no purpose behind the universe, there's no purpose behind our lives, it's all just an accident, it's all just statistics, move on and don't worry about there being any God or any purpose for your life, that's not a good philosophy for a civilization to have. In fact, I think that's ultimately a deadly philosophy for a civilization to have.
Yeah, I was going to say, not for one that wants to survive. Might I ask, Doctor, how you got from being in the hard sciences, which you're clearly very much in, to writing this book?
Well, I think it goes back to my childhood, actually. When I was about 6 years old, I knew pretty certainly that there were two things in life I wanted to do. One was to become an astronomer, and the other to become a Catholic priest. I had a very religious mother. And so I was fixated on becoming a Catholic priest, and I went to a high school in Indianapolis called the Latin School of Indianapolis, which was a preparatory school for the seminary. Did very well there and graduated. I went on to the St. Meinrad Benedictine Archabbey Seminary in southern Indiana, which was the next step in the road to the priesthood. Now, I left that when I was finished with my freshman year because it was I began to have some differences with the Catholic Church about some fundamental issues like birth control and divorce and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to leave that part of my life's aspirations behind and dedicate my full attention to becoming an astronomer, which I did. But I guess my openness to some of these ideas of spirituality and our human nature as being more than simply a collection of chemicals, that does go back to my upbringing and to the fact that I studied to be a Catholic priest, and so I'm not uncomfortable with the idea of spirituality, although I am uncomfortable with the ideas of some of the baser aspects of religion.
That's remarkable. Let me note, your background is remarkable. Let me note for you and for the audience, and I've said this previously, I, of course, am on the other side of the world from you. I'm in the Philippines. The Philippine Islands are approximately 87% Catholic. In the United States, we have separated religion and the state to a large degree, to the point where religious symbols and so forth are on a regular basis ejected from public property and so forth and so on. Here in the Philippines, religion is part of the state, is actually part of the state, in fact, drives the state, in fact, drives the laws. So here, of course, there is no abortion. Here, of course, there is no divorce. Here, of course, you see crosses and you see religious artifacts on almost demanded to be on public property. They hang from lamp posts and public light posts and you name it, and you see it here. And in the Philippines, although there is abject poverty everywhere, there also remains a incredibly strong sense of family, Doctor, that that we haven't seen in the U.S. for decades. And so religion here does seem to have positive influences of some sorts. Now, it's not all roses, mind you, because there's no divorce. So a lot of people end up leaving their partner, and it's just the biggest mess you ever saw in your whole life. But family is paramount here. And if you look at the U.S., where we've tried to remove God from all public view, there have begun to be some problems as a result of it. Now, perhaps you have comment on that.
Well, I do. I think that it's important to separate the misuse of religion by human beings and the existence of God. They're two totally different things. And that's why when I read Sam Harris's book on the A Letter to a Christian Nation, I found myself in agreement with most everything he said, because religion has been misused by human beings to do the most awful things. Fine, I accept that. It's true. But does that mean there's no God? No, it has nothing to do with that. These are two totally orthogonal questions. And I think that the rejection of any kind of notion of God by a society and the removal of any kind of reference to the possibility of there being a God, I think that can have some negative social consequences. And so I can see that some of the positive aspects of a belief in something other than secular humanism could be a positive thing for society. But the problem is, if you let religions go to their extremes, then you can create even worse problems. So I'm kind of torn on that point.
Mm-hmm. As am I. It's just something that I noticed, having moved to the other side of the world, that I thought was very, very interesting. How long has your book been out, Doctor?
Came out in May. It's been, I've got to say, I put 30 years worth of thought into this book. It's really kind of a distillation of my decades of being exposed to science, being part of the scientific community, writing research papers, and mulling over the same questions I've thought ever since I left the seminary. Is there a God? What is the purpose of my life? What's the purpose of the universe? And so I've really tried to distill 30 years of seeing things from both sides of the fence into a book that proposes something that I do think you can believe in if you want to. You don't have to.
How has your book been greeted by your colleagues?
You know, I don't really hold the book up to my colleagues and say, here, look at this, because I realize that, as I said when we started the interview, 93% of the members of the National Academy of Sciences reject God. So I assume probably 93% of my colleagues probably feel the same way. So I don't put my book up in their face and say, look what I wrote. You know, it's, I kind of have gotten myself into enough hot water, perhaps, by writing it in the first place. So I don't promote it among my professional colleagues.
So, but still, there must have been some feedback. Somebody must have sent you an email saying, hey, what happened to you?
No, you know, I've gotten nothing negative.
Really?
If you look at at Amazon.com, you'll find that the reviews I've gotten from people are quite positive. I've got essentially a 5-star review from the average of the 23. But I've gotten nothing negative from any colleagues of mine, which may just mean that they're totally oblivious to the fact I've written this book, which would be fine with me for a while anyway.
Fascinating. Well, I can imagine it got 5 stars. The whole concept deserves 5 stars easily. All right. Well, let's talk a bit about your twist on creation. Science and the best theoretical physicists, why you talk to them, Doctor, and they tell you one of several things, but one thing they all seem to agree on is that prior to the Big Bang, they don't know a damn thing. Nothing. Zero, zip, nothing. But they will tell you that from something smaller, perhaps, than a quark, came all that is. They just don't know how that happened. And, that's music. That means we're at a break point. So when we get back, perhaps we can talk about that instant that nobody seems to understand at all. Would that be all right?
That'd be just fine. Let's dive in.
Good. All right. Dr. Bernard Heisch is my guest. He has written a book that I think you want to go get your hands on right away. It's called The God Theory, Universes, Zero Point Fields, and what's beyond it all. I hope you're not just joining us. That would be a real shame because you've missed a lot. Dr. Bernard Heisch is my guest, and boy, are we deep into it. What a wonderful interview. We'll get back to it in just a moment. Stay right there. All right. As I said prior to the break, Doctor, I've always had this, I've interviewed so many scientists that, and they tell me, the theoretical guys, that everything we see, all the stars and all the planets and all this immense everything came from something apparently smaller than a quark, something so small we can't even right now, I guess, do anything other than imagine it. It's just too much to contemplate. What's your take on it?
Well, yeah, the thing that you're alluding to is the Big Bang, because we know the universe began 13.7 billion years ago. The universe came out of something that was as incredibly tiny as you describe, and that's pretty well known. And in fact, there was the Nobel Prize that was awarded this year for measuring what the universe was like early in its life cycle. So, yes, that's true. And the question is, what came prior to that? What was the cause of that? But before we get into that, I guess it's worth noting that I'm not entirely alone among scientists in thinking that, there is a deeper explanation for the origin of the universe that involves an intelligence of some kind. For example, Sir Fred Hoyle, who was the British cosmologist who coined the term Big Bang, in a 1995 Scientific American article, he's reported as saying that the universe looked to him like an obvious fix, and attributed that to an intelligence. Max Planck, the father of quantum theory, in his book The Universe in the Light of Modern Physics, wrote that there are realities existing apart from our sense perceptions. And I've already mentioned Sir James Jeans and his ideas that the universe looked more like a great thought than a great machine. And then there's Sir Arthur Eddington. He's the scientist who made Einstein famous, because in 1919 he's the one that led the eclipse expedition that measured the deflection of starlight that proved that general relativity was correct. So Eddington was a great promoter of Einstein. He wrote one of the first textbooks on general relativity. He was the one who discovered how stars shine. In other words, he was the first to propose that thermonuclear reactions drive stars and wrote a textbook on that. But he also wrote a book called Science and the Unseen World, because he was a mystic. He thought that there were other realities beyond the physical. So I'm not entirely alone in my thinking. There are some very prominent and deep thinkers who've shared some of these ideas.
Okay, so it is your view then that it did occur that way, and that there was a creator that made that happen.
Indeed, I think that the Big Bang is a great way to start a universe. I mean, if I had to start a universe, I'd do it the same way, I guess. But the question is, what came before that? And it's even a question whether this is a legitimate question, because I think that space and time probably came into being along with the Big Bang itself. And so the question of what came before takes on kind of a deeper, fuzzier significance, because we can't really extrapolate time to an even earlier event that preceded the universe, because probably there was no time at all. But you do need some kind of pre-existing something to make something happen.
You can only imagine a great emptiness. That's it. You can imagine a great emptiness prior to this.
You could, but if there weren't any quantum laws, then you couldn't even have a quantum fluctuation. If there weren't any inflation fields, you wouldn't have the inflation that's thought to drive the early universe. You need the preexistence of something in order to make anything happen.
Well, if there was just great emptiness, Doctor, and there were no, you didn't even have two objects. I mean, in order to even have time, a measurable thing, you must have one object moving in relationship to another, yes?
That's exactly correct, yes.
Well, I guess we're both in an area that you can only speculate about, but it really does inevitably lead to something so much greater than ourselves that it has to be a God. So why is it that scientists can't or won't make that little leap, or big leap?
Well, I think that there is this, as I said before, this historic problem of the conflict between science and religion that goes back to back centuries, to Galileo and Bruno and so on. And there's also the problem that I think we need a more modern, up-to-date concept of God. I think the concept of God that we have in many religions is very anthropomorphic, and as such, it's been the source of a lot of conflict. It's been the source of a lot of abuse and misuse of powers. Mm-hmm. And I think that science is reacting to notions of God that are too simple to be true. That I think if we have a concept of God as an intelligence behind the universe, not one that microengineers life forms and creates the universe that is a 6,000-year-old universe, that makes no sense at all. I think it's possible to come up with a concept of God that even a hardcore scientist would say, well, that's an acceptable idea. I may or may not believe that. In fact, I probably won't believe anything because as a scientist, I don't believe things. I insist on proof. But it's a possibility I will hold in mind, one that I think stands on equal logical ground with the idea that there is no God and that everything can be traced back to some kind of quantum fluctuation or inflation field. But where do those come from? So we're at terra incognita here, and it cannot be proven one way or the other. I'm not claiming in my book that I've proven anything, only that there are two possibilities and that you can accept whichever one you want. But, you know, I think there's actually a slight edge for the possibility that there is an intelligence. And that has to do with the reports throughout the ages of mystics and the prayerful and spontaneous, exceptional human experiences people have had. People have communed with this intelligence throughout history.
Oh, yes.
And that's part
of
our human knowledge. And I think to discard that and say, well, that's not scientific evidence, you can do that. But I think we'll discover in the century ahead that there is reality to those kinds of perceptions and that there's much to be learned from that.
Well, as quickly, Doctor, as science is now moving, maybe toward the quantum world, do you think it's possible that science may one day run right into God?
Very good question. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm hoping is that someday the knowledge of our spiritual nature, the understanding of our spiritual characteristics, of our spiritual abilities, of the nature of our consciousness, that will become part of the scientific mainstream. And we'll begin to explore things that sometimes are pejoratively just thrown out as, quote, supernatural, as part of what a greater science has to encompass.
What do you suppose socially would occur if science did what it's so unlikely to do, and that is actually prove the existence of God?
Well, I guess if it did, I suspect and I hope it would be a more peaceful world, because if we had that as a common belief, we could begin to perhaps work together better, more peacefully, to try to understand what that means, to try to understand what the implication is for us as human beings, for the purpose of our lives. So I think that would be a very good thing, a very hopeful thing. I don't see that as very likely, though, because I don't think that these things can be proven, at least not until perhaps our own consciousness comes to the state where we can directly experience this and know for a fact things that we just have direct experience of, rather than the need for experimental proof.
So then it would probably be your view that the path to God is an understanding, an exploration of consciousness itself.
I think so. I think consciousness is going to be the center stage in this century, and that it'll probably be more important to understand that than to understand some of the problems that now are center stage in physics and astrophysics and biology.
Do you suppose that the difference between those life forms and civilizations that make it and those that don't might be those that discover this path versus those who don't, those who stay with the material, with the bombs and the biological terrors that we all know about?
Well, I think that ultimately a kind of morality that a society needs can't really be grounded in something that denies our basic nature. And
here,
I think that our basic nature is that of consciousness. And I think we're getting into trouble if we look at ourselves strictly from a reductionist, materialist perspective. And I think that the philosophy underlying that is one that it's unsustainable for a civilization to be built upon.
Mm-hmm. Are you beginning to achieve this with the book? Are you getting any feedback that indicates to you you're making some progress?
Well, it's a little hard to say. The book hasn't been out all that long, and it hasn't gotten a huge amount of promotion. So the book is, it's there, but it's not one of the best sellers yet. I'm hoping it is, because I wrote it not because I want to make a ton of money on it, but because I think the ideas I'm presenting offer a new perspective for a world that's in deep, deep trouble. And it kind of goes hand in hand, actually, with what I'm doing professionally as a working on a project called the Digital Universe that we haven't discussed yet, but maybe we can for a few minutes.
Proceed.
Science education project. And I think that the idea of presenting to the public information that's not driven purely by commercial purposes is something that will also be of use to the world. And that's what I'm spending all my time on professionally. And between that and writing the book, I hope I've made some contribution to providing a more positive trajectory for the world to discover.
I am terribly concerned, Doctor, about the amount of scientific ignorance in this country right now. It will make you sad if you look at, for some reason, we're still turning out young scientists, but it just doesn't seem like people are turning to science at the rate they once were.
Well, I think that's correct. I think the U.S. is losing its edge, and I think some of that is due to, unfortunately, some of that is due to religious influences that seem to be opposed to science, that see science as the enemy, and unfortunately, some scientists see religion as the enemy. And so with that kind of tension between the two worlds, I think that a decline of interest in science is something you might expect. And again, that's why the kind of middle road perspective I'm presenting, which is to conceive of a God that's consistent with everything we know in science, consistent with the Big Bang, consistent with evolution, that offers us a view that I think can resolve this tension and make people interested in pursuing science, even if they want to discover God, even if they want to be very close to God personally. They don't have to reject that to pursue a career in science. The way it is now, you can feel very uncomfortable, I suppose, if you are a very religious person, a devout person, and you want to become a scientist when 93% of the members of the Academy of Sciences reject God. And I think that's pretty much the percentage you'd find in the scientific community overall. So this kind of a hostile environment toward the person that might be a very devout person that communes with God. And I think that that's part of the problem.
I mean, that even includes the majority of the medical community, Doctor.
I think the medical community is much more open to the idea that there is an intelligence behind the universe, because it's not so... It is more tied to the human nature, to human reality, to human thought and experience, rather than to purely mathematical analysis. So I think the medical community is somewhat more open than is the world of physical science.
But you would be, for example, if you wanted to introduce this as a course in a university, you'd be run out of town on a rail.
Well, you're right. These ideas are not ready for prime time in that sense. And I'm hoping that, I mean, perhaps I'm being optimistic, but I'm hoping that my book could start a dialogue between scientists that have an open mind and people that do believe in God, but that see some of the drawbacks and pitfalls of organized religions, and they're looking for a middle ground.
Well, in a way, though, isn't science likely to ultimately do itself in the sense that as it even goes down the road that it has carved out for itself, it inevitably, when it goes far enough, is going to get to a juncture that meets up with spirituality?
Well, I think it will, and I think science will rise to the occasion, because scientists are smart people, and science has been very successful, and I see a future in which science will be carried on, looking into realms that at this point are being excluded from science, but that will of necessity become part of it. And perhaps the world will be better off someday if we have science but not religion. I think that religion has become a very divisive thing, but to have a spirituality that finds a study of spirituality that finds its place among the branches of knowledge of science, that would be a very good and a very desirable thing.
It'll probably be a pretty difficult moment for science, to be sure. But I have this feeling that we are sort of racing toward that. There are areas of science right now that are going to be that are bumping into this. And again, I point to the work at Princeton. It's small, I agree, but it's beginning to move into areas that are fuzzy.
Well, I think that's right. As I said, I know the work at Princeton. I deeply respect it. I published some of that in the journal that I edited. And I think that, science could take off some of its own dogmatism and look at things like this, at results like this, experiments that, like the ones carried on at Princeton, openly and with an open mind. There's a lot to discover there. The problem is that there are many scientists who I think suffer from the religion of scientism. If you take the view that science has proven that there is no God and that there cannot be any spiritual realities, then you've also become a believer. You become a believer in something that you might as well call scientism. The belief of scientism, belief in scientism, is effectively a religious dogma. And that's not a healthy thing. And the scientific method is one thing. The scientism that goes along with thinking that you've uncovered what is possible and what is not possible, and that what is possible does not include any kind of spirituality or God, that's not the scientific method, and that's not behaving the way a scientist should.
So, from your perspective, Doctor, if you were to run into a depressed person who's asking the world and God and anybody else who will listen, what is the purpose of my life? How would you instruct them?
Well, I go directly to the heart of that in the book, because what I'm proposing is that life is all about giving God his experience. I imagine God to be an intelligence of infinite potential, of infinite ability. But potential is a very sterile thing. It's one thing to have potential. It's another thing to have experience. And I think what God does, again, thinking along the lines of what Sir James Jeans wrote many years ago, I think what God does is to take some of his ideas and have those ideas become the laws of nature of a universe like ours. And then the universe takes off and does what it can do within those laws. Let's evolution take place. Let's life forms arise. And then you have the ability for that intelligent consciousness to enter those life forms and to take its potential and have experience instead, to live as a human being, to live as a frog, to live as a turtle, to live as an alien in some other civilization. I think that's what the purpose of the universe is, because that way the intelligence behind it gets to experience itself. In fact, that's what some of the esoteric aspects of some of our religions actually allude to, for example, in Kabbalah. That sort of thing is alluded to. And I suspect that's what the reason is behind the universe. And so if that's the case, then our purpose in life is to give God his experience. And in fact, we're giving God our own experience because we are, in that sense, God.
Doctor, back to reincarnation for a moment, just based on what you said. Do you think that consciousness is a big crapshoot? That is to say, do you believe, for example, that in one life a human consciousness may be in the next a frog?
I don't think you go backwards. I think it's upwards. I think if you're a human being, you come back as a human being, or perhaps you graduate to something better. I mean, I'm not excluding the possibility that you might wind up in some other civilization somewhere else in the universe. If you've lived a good life, preferably that's a better civilization. But I don't think that you go backwards. I don't think you can wind up as a cockroach or something like that. Perhaps if you've done very terrible things, perhaps if you're Saddam Hussein, you might come back as a cockroach. I don't know. But I generally don't think that's the case.
Well, they did find him in a hole.
Good point. Very good point.
All right, listen, I have pretty well dominated you selfishly here for a couple of hours, and it's been just absolutely incredible. What I want to do is allow the audience to have a crack at you. That's what we sort of traditionally do in the last hour. And it'll be interesting, I think, to see what... you're liable to get anything. Remember that there's every person, every manner of person listening, many of them devout Catholics, for example, or what have you, every manner of person. So you're going to have to prepare yourself for nearly anything. Can you do that?
I think I can do that.
All right. Dr. Bernard Heisch is my guest. Ladies and gentlemen, go get his book, The God Theory, Universes, Zero-Point Fields, and What's Behind It All. I don't see how you can resist. I'm sure you can go to Amazon. The God Theory, Universes, Zero-Point Fields, and What's Beyond It All. I'm Art Bell.